Welcome back to the second half of Earth First Radio. I'm Uncle Dennis, and there's more important information coming up, so please keep that pencil and recycled paper handy. And right now we're going to get right back into our commentary like we do every year. And since we're reporting on the St. Louis Mowrage Monsanto action, let's talk a little bit about what Monsanto's seed invasion is all about. This one is Farmers Fight Monsanto's Seed Invasion, Canola Farmer Fights Seed Invasion. This was written by Heather Schofield of the Globe and Mail on Monday, August 14th. From Ottawa, Saskatchewan canola farmer Laverne Affleck thought long and hard before going public with his concerns about genetically modified seeds. Many people are fearful of the environmental and health effects of modified seeds, which are altered with genes from other plants or animals to make them resistant to herbicides. But Mr. Affleck found much of the criticism too radical or irrational for his taste. However, after he saw herbicide-resistant canola unexpectedly popping up all over his fields this spring and learned about other farmers whose fields were also invaded by modified seeds spreading from neighboring farms, he figured the time had come to speak out. Quoting here, "I'm not anti-technology, but I'm having trouble with this one," Mr. Affleck said in an interview earlier this summer from his farm near Moosomin, Saskatchewan. Mr. Affleck said in an interview earlier, "We are not environmentalists. We are not against science. We readily adopt new ideas and implement them on our farm and businesses. We like to see progress," said. "However, in the case of GMOs, genetically modified organisms, we feel that we are being unwillingly swept into a situation where that science is working against us." More and more farmers have been expressing their concern that genetically modified canola may be out of control in the prairies of Canada, said Percy Schmeiser. Mr. Schmeiser is the Saskatchewan farmer who has been battling biotechnology multinational Monsanto Company in federal court. St. Louis-based Monsanto has accused Mr. Schmeiser of breaking patent laws by obtaining Monsanto's genetically modified Roundup Ready canola seed, breeding it and planting it without paying Monsanto the required fees. Monsanto and Mr. Schmeiser finished their court hearings last month, and now they're waiting for a decision expected in September at the earliest. In the meantime, publicity surrounding the trial has prompted dozens of farmers to contact Mr. Schmeiser to discuss their concerns about out-of-control canola, Mr. Schmeiser said. "I've had at least 100 farmers across the West telling me about problems they're having with volunteer canola. It's just unreal the number of people who have canola in their fields after they've sprayed. So-called volunteers are canola plants that sprout in a farmer's field even though they weren't planted there by the farmer. Most volunteer canola spreads by wind or in pollen carried by bees. The farmers talking to Mr. Schmeiser say they're finding large amounts of volunteer canola in their grain fields, and because much of that volunteer canola is genetically modified to withstand Roundup, a powerful weed killer made by Monsanto, farmers complain they're having to adopt increasingly complex and expensive systems of spraying herbicides to keep the volunteer canola at bay and out of their fields. We've lost control of it now," Mr. Schmeiser said. "This is a very serious thing." Monsanto agrees that its Roundup Ready canola can spread, but insists that controlling the spread is no different than for any other type of plant, except that you can't spray Roundup on it. It doesn't work. "All it takes is good farm management," said Craig Evans, general manager of biotechnology for Monsanto Canada Incorporated. "It's not a new phenomenon," he said in an interview from Saskatoon. "Can genetically modified canola outcrop?" That means volunteer. "Yes, it can, but no more so than any other crop." The federal government body that regulates genetically modified seeds is not so sure Roundup Ready canola is under control. Asked whether Roundup Ready canola was out of control, Bart Bilmer, a spokesman for the Office of Biotechnology for the Canadian Food Inspection Agency, was unclear. "Certainly it's been a question that's been raised," he said. "That's my answer." For Mr. Affleck, the prevalence of Roundup Ready canola has meant the loss of a major weed control tool. He has never planted Monsanto's canola because he makes extensive use of the Roundup herbicide to control weeds on his crops. He didn't want any plant that was resistant to Roundup mixed in with his system. But a strong windstorm blew swaths of Roundup Ready canola onto his fields, and now he can't effectively use Roundup any longer to control weeds in his crops. He's had to add another herbicide to the roster to get rid of the genetically modified canola growing like weeds among his wheat. It may be necessary to use a lot more potentially more harmful chemicals to kill this monster, he said. When he called Monsanto about the problem and the company agreed to pay for the treatment, but he's not so sure Monsanto will be around to pick up the bill every year, and evidence is growing that Monsanto's canola is not only resistant to Roundup, but is also becoming resistant to other herbicides as well, a suspicion that the Canadian Food Inspection Agency shares. I will never get rid of that crop, and I will never be able to grow an organic crop, he said, and for the future, I will never be able to effectively use Roundup for my weed control. Monsanto, however, said it has received only 15 complaints about volunteer canola in 5 years of selling the genetically modified seeds on the prairies, and in every case has been well looked after. Indeed, Mr. Evans said more and more farmers have been embracing Monsanto's modified canola, and the company's market share in the Western Canada has risen steadily. This has had virtually no effect on the business, he said. Manitoba farmer and seed grower Wayne Duby has no ideological problem with genetically modified seeds and didn't have much sympathy for Mr. Schmeiser in his legal battle with Monsanto. He has no problem with Monsanto trying to protect its patent, but he does want to see Monsanto and other multinational biotech corporations take responsibility for volunteer crops and the sprays needed to keep them under control. If they're going to produce a seed that's genetically modified, they should be able to guarantee some kind of control, he said in an interview from his farm near Alexander, Manitoba. They should be responsible for it. And that's our commentary today on Earth First Radio, written by Heather Schofield of the Ottawa Globe and Mail. And we thank her for her commentary. And let's move right on in to animal, plant, and habitat climate news here. Let's start off with Arctic meltdown. New evidence emerges. The Arctic ice cap is melting so fast that scientists fear it could disappear entirely every summer in just 50 years. Researchers at Norway's University of Bergen suggest the thickness of the ice is decreasing by almost 15% each decade because of global warming. Quote, the changes we have seen have been much faster and more dramatic than most people imagine, said Tor Furufuk. His findings predict dramatic impacts on local wildlife, including walruses, grizzly bears, caribou, and Arctic foxes, who are becoming endangered as their habitat is eroding. Polar bears, native only to the Arctic, are threatened with extinction. The effect on weather systems of the Arctic meltdown would be felt worldwide, and Britain could get colder as a result as the ice melt counteracts the Gulf Stream. This is one of numerous studies that indicate the frozen sea over the North Pole is rapidly melting. In November, the Norwegian Polar Institute reported that previously confidential U.S. submarine investigations showed the thickness of the ice has decreased by a meter in the last 30 years, a factor of 40%. More recently, the results of a 7-year survey by NASA indicates that Greenland's ice sheet is melting at a rate of more than 3 feet a year in places and provides the first evidence that melting in the massive ice sheet is contributing to a rise in sea level. And Earth First Radio brought you that news a couple of weeks ago. Almost 85% of Greenland is covered by ice. A new aerial survey showed that more than 51 cubic kilometers are vanishing each year from the Greenland ice sheet, changes that could be caused by global warming as well as glacial movement. Quote, why the ice margins are thinning so rapidly warrants additional study, said Bill Krabbel, project scientist at NASA. It may indicate the coastal margins of the ice sheets are capable of responding more rapidly than we thought to external changes such as a warming climate. The team is sure that continued melting will lead to higher sea levels in the future. A rise of even a few inches could inundate low-lying coastal areas. For the first time, we are seeing evidence of one of the two great ice bodies on Earth, the other is the Antarctic ice sheet, is contributing in a modest fashion to observed sea level rises, said Dr. Grasim Ashar, Associate Administrator for NASA's Office of Earth Science. Moving to Africa. The use of and trade in meat from wild animals, called bushmeat, is one of the greatest direct causes of decline of wild animal populations in many parts of Africa, according to a new comprehensive survey of 7 East and Southern African countries. The report released by TRAFIC, the wildlife trade monitoring arm of the World Wildlife Fund and the World Conservation Union, urged that integrated action be taken to halt the unsustainable use of bushmeat, including promoting initiatives to transfer wildlife ownership to landowners and securing land tenure. Traffic conducted the most extensive review ever undertaken of trade and utilization of wild meat in seven East and Southern African countries, including Botswana, Kenya, Malawi, Mozambique, Tanzania, Zambia, and Zimbabwe. A total of 23 surveys were conducted, of which 16 were focused on illegal use of wildlife. The study was sponsored by the European Commission. The report, Food for Thought, the Utilization of Wild Meat in Eastern and Southern Africa, recognizes that bushmeat is also a valuable source of cheap protein and cash income for many human populations struggling for survival amidst poverty and frequent famine. Thousands of species, from insects, rodents, and birds to buffalo, elephants, and impalas, are used as bushmeat throughout the areas studied. Traffic East and Southern Africa senior program officer and author of the report, Rob Barnett, revealed that many populations of these species are declining rapidly as a result of increasing hunting pressure. The use of wildlife for food in the region is one of the main factors driving declines in wild animal populations, he said. Hunting is moving into protected areas where bushmeat harvest is now the number one illegal activity, Barnett said. Even smaller species are being targeted as a result of the declining populations of larger game. With declining populations of more popular species such as buffalo, hunters have now turned their attention to once taboo and totem species such as zebra and hippo, Barnett warns. What was once subsistence use of these species is also becoming a much more commercialized trade. Traditional hunter-gatherers, rural farming, and herding communities consume bushmeat, and it is also eaten in urban centers in the region. It is the poorer households that are most reliant on wild meat. Bushmeat was found to be much cheaper than domestic meat in six of the seven countries surveyed, 75% cheaper than domestic meat in Zimbabwe. During times of economic hardship, drought, and famine, bushmeat is often the only food available. Peak hunting periods coincide with dry season drought months as vegetation is less dense and wildlife searching for watering holes is easier to hunt and locate, Barnett explained. Hence, supply peaks during times of hardship and constitutes an important drought and famine coping strategy for a majority of the rural areas surveyed. It is also a vital source of income in many communities of the region. In the western Serengeti of Tanzania, for example, more than a third of traders relied on bushmeat as their sole source of income, Barnett said. Traffic predicts that demand for bushmeat will continue to rise because human populations in the region are also increasing and standards of living are generally falling. This demand will contribute to a reduction in wildlife populations. The depletion of wildlife valued as a source of meat is likely to have a negative impact not only on the huge variety of species, but also importantly on food security and the livelihoods and nutritional status of local communities in all countries of the region, Barnett said. Traffic predicts that demand for bushmeat will continue to rise because human populations in the region are increasing and standard of living are generally falling. Again, I don't know why that sentence repeated there. This demand will contribute to a... for some reason, that got repeated. Anyway, let's move on. The Center for Biological Diversity and a coalition of other conservation groups have filed a formal notice of intent to sue the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service over the agency's failure to respond to petitions to designate the California spotted owl, the Yosemite toad, and the Sierra Nevada population of the mountain yellow-legged frogs as endangered species under the Endangered Species Act. By failing to take the required action on these petitions, the federal government is abdicating its responsibility of breaking the law, said Scott Hoffman Black, executive director for the Center for Biological Diversity. The federal government is violating the Endangered Species Act. Populations of all three animals are in decline in the Sierra Nevada. Studies show the California spotted owls are declining by 7 to 10% a year. Recent surveys report that the Yosemite toad and the Sierra Nevada population of the mountain yellow-legged frog have disappeared from a majority of their historic range. The extent of amphibian declines in the Sierra Nevada is disturbing because it shows that we've done a poor job of protecting aquatic ecosystems on federal land, said Jeff Miller, a biologist for the Center of Biological Diversity's Berkeley office. If the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service does not act within 60 days, the Center, the Sierra Nevada Forest Protection Campaign, and the National Resources Natural Resources Defense Council plan to pursue legal action, and they're looking to get them protected soon. And an international focus on vanishing and deformed amphibians like frogs, toads, and salamanders has masked the problem of another group of animals, reptiles. A new report says that reptiles, including turtles, lizards, alligators, and snakes, are in even greater distress worldwide than their better-known cousins. These two classes of animals are closely related, but the focus of general concern has almost been exclusively on amphibians. The article's lead author, Dr. Whit Gibbons, a herpetologist and professor of ecology at the University of Georgia, said that although the amphibian decline problem is a serious threat, reptiles appear to be even greater danger of extinction worldwide. Habitat loss and degradation may be the largest single factor in reptile loss. And grizzly bears are still in trouble after 25 years. At the 25th anniversary of the listing of grizzly bears as a threatened species, the Sierra Club says Endangered Species Act is the primary reason that the species has survived in the lower 48 United States. Thanks to a strong Endangered Species Act, we can still find grizzlies in the wilds of the Northern Rockies, stated Louisa Wilcox, project coordinator of the Sierra Club Grizzly Bear Ecosystems Project. Today, after 25 years of federal protection, we celebrate the protections of the Endangered Species Act that have helped to stabilize the populations of grizzly bears in the lower 48. But we realize there is still a long road ahead to a full recovery. Wilcox added that threats to grizzlies have increased and intensified over the last 25 years. In addition to the traditional threats from logging, oil and gas development, and mining, sprawl and off-road vehicles are now also tearing up their habitat. Today, just 1,000 grizzly bears, about 1% of the total grizzly population present 200 years ago, live on 1 to 2% of their historic range in five isolated ecosystems scattered across Wyoming, Montana, Idaho, and Washington states. Destruction of the grizzly bear habitat is accelerating. Since the listing of the grizzly in 1975, 568,000 acres of grizzly habitat in the Northern Continental Divide ecosystem have been lost to logging and roads. Accidental shootings by black bear hunters have further reduced grizzly numbers. Here we are just halfway through the year and we've already exceeded the mortality cap for female bears. We are supposed to be celebrating 25 years of ESA protections, but instead we are watching in dismay as we lose increasing numbers of grizzlies to a few careless hunters, said Brian Peck, a wildlife consultant for the Sierra Club Grizzly Bear Ecosystems Project. And environmentalists say that voles are at risk. This is an article by Greg Bolt of the Registered Guard. Environmentalists trying to block an old-growth timber sale in the Fall Creek area say they've found more evidence that the stands are home to a protected species of tree vole and again called on the U.S. Forest Service to cancel the sale. Members of the Canopy Action Network held a news conference outside the downtown federal building in Eugene, Oregon, a few weeks ago to announce they had found more red tree vole nests in the Clark timber sale. A small mouse-like creature is food for the endangered spotted owl. The vole lives mostly in the upper canopy of old-growth Douglas firs and is considered a sensitive species under the Forest Service management plans. Quote, "We feel it is time for the Forest Service to do the right thing and protect the red tree vole nest that we have found," said Aaron Volheim, a member of the environmental group. Members have several environmental groups have set up platforms in old-growth trees in both the Clark and nearby Winbury timber sale units to prevent logging. The tree sitters have been occupying the perches for 2.5 years as the legal battle over logging continues. The Forest Service is required to look for species such as the red tree vole under a variety of forest management policies, as well as an agreement that settled a pending lawsuit. Logging has now been delayed while surveys are being carried out. And the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has extended endangered species status for the short-tailed albatross to include the bird's range within the U.S. The short-tailed albatross has been listed as endangered under the U.S. Endangered Species Act since 1973, but an administrative error in the original listing excluded the U.S. from the area in which the endangered species status applies. Individual birds that occur in the U.S. have not been protected under the provisions of the Act until now. The short-tailed albatross is a large seabird with long, narrow wings adapted for flying just above the surface of the water. It occurs in the northern Pacific Ocean as far south as the northwestern Hawaiian Islands and as far north as the central Bering Sea. The only known short-tailed albatross breeding colonies are on two remote Japanese islands in the western Pacific Ocean, Torishima Island and Manami Kojima Island. And illegal quarrying threatens a rare landscape. Modern gardening has hit this ancient landscape. One of Britain's rarest habitats is being destroyed to provide stone garden rockeries, according to research carried out by the Countryside Agency of Britain. Despite being protected by law, limestone pavement is still being illegally quarried. Only about 3,000 hectares remain in the United Kingdom of a geological feature created by the erosion of sedimentary rock formed millions of years ago. Thousands of tons disappear annually, and only 3% of the landscape has remained intact. The look of the water-worn limestone has made it popular with gardeners. It is mostly sold for rockeries or water features. The Yorkshire Dales National Park, which is characterized by its outcrops of limestone pavement, have suffered at the hands of enthusiastic landscape artists. Even the removal of small slabs of the 12,000-year-old limestone pavements in the Dales can kill many ecosystems that live in the crevices. The Countryside Agency, which advises the government, said 2,500 tons of the rock is taken illegally each year in the United Kingdom. The agency said it hoped to raise a public awareness of the environmental impact, urging gardeners to find alternatives such as deep quarried limestone or even artificial substitutes. And in a setback to the protection of the Haleakala National Park in Hawaii from new introductions of alien species, a three-judge panel of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has denied the National Park Conservation Association's petition for the review of the environmental impact statement on the expansion of the Kahului Airport in Maui to allow flights from Asia. The NPCA had filed suit against the Federal Aviation Administration last year on the grounds that the internationalization failed to assess the threat of non-native species that could be introduced. Moreover, the project only provides for cursory levels of mitigation, which are neither required nor funded. The Kahului Airport project has been proposed for over 10 years. Twice the FAA has prepared an EIS, supposedly for the purpose of analyzing all the environmental impacts. The first EIS was invalidated by state courts, in part due to its failure to address impacts related to non-native species. Already, Haleakala is battling such invaders as the Argentine ant, avian malaria, and a plant called Myconia, or the Green Death. Without strict quarantine and control mechanisms, international flights have the potential to bring even more devastating plants and animals to the islands of Maui and the Hawaiian Islands, including the infamous brown tree snake, which has all but eliminated bird life on Guam. And unfortunately, that's about all the time we have for news on Earth First Radio. To get news and announcements from your bioregion to Earth First Radio, send us email. Our email address is cruzef@cruzio.com. That's cruzef@cruzio.com. Or you can send letters to Earth First Radio. Our address, P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. Once again, that's Earth First Radio. We're at P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. And be sure to send those announcements at least 3 weeks in advance. If you'd like more in-depth news or information about the Earth First movement, please subscribe to the Earth First Journal. Their address, P.O. Box 1415, Eugene, Oregon, 97440. Once again, that's the Earth First Journal, P.O. 1415, Eugene, Oregon, 94440. And you can listen to Earth First Radio live every night at 8 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time. If we are up and running on our website, it's www.radio.net/FRSC. Once again, that web address, www.radio.net/FRSC, and download the player, and then you can listen in. There are lots of great shows on Free Radio Santa Cruz anytime. Or if you want to, you can always find Earth First Radio archive shows on the World Wide Web at www.radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net. The software you need to play the MP3 files is free downloading on the website. Earth First Radio is carried on a growing number of free speech and non-commercial radio stations. Please ask your local station to rebroadcast Earth First Radio. Earth First Radio is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. Our theme music was written and performed by Daryl Cherney, and that's off the CD Keep It Wild. I'm Uncle Dennis. I want to thank you for listening to Earth First Radio. And now we're going to listen to a little music. This is by the Weird Sisters, this is by the Tinklers off of a CD called If a Tree Falls. A lot of great music on this CD. I'm not sure it's still available, but this one's called Trees Like to Rot in the Forests.
Well, I'm not a volunteering freak, but as I was sitting here last week, Lately I've been